Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So, whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 383.PR2301, certificate number 48479. The Duchess of Bedford. The Duchess of Bedford.
The king and queen are coming to Downton. I did not see the Downton Abbey movie, but my wife says I should not see it.
I've only watched season one of Downton Abbey, and I liked it very much, but I didn't feel like I wanted to see season two because I don't like Decline and Fall.
The trailer of, like, you don't like when things decline and fall, or you don't like the novel Decline and Fall?
No, right? I like the novel Decline and Fall. Oh. I don't like it when things decline and fall.
Do any of us?
Some do.
I'm at the age where parts of my body are going to decline and fall.
No, I think young people love to see things decline and fall because it means
it's not them.
Yeah, it ushers in a new age. Whereas people that are invested in the way things are, like you and me, who are like, don't change the recipe of Kraft macaroni and cheese. And then they're like, oh, it's now made out of Soylent.
That's, like, that's no, the recipe.
Stop it.
It's made out of Robert Kraft. The Downton Abbey trailer cracked me up because, first of all, there's no conflict at all. It's, you know how trailers are always like about what the stakes are and here's what our hero's going to try to do?
Yeah.
The Downton Abbey trailer is like, a bunch of us are in a house and look, it's an invitation from the king and queen. And that's literally all that happens.
Really?
Yeah. Yay. It's like, we're going to have a party.
But then, I guess, hold your horses.
I guess that's the premise of Mrs. Dalloway as well. Maybe it's a very tense, fraught thing.
Does the movie happen in an alternate Downton Abbey universe, or is it a continuation
it's
of the
Earth
story?
Two.
I mean, does it happen like after World War One, or
is Carson of Earth Two?
Do we go back? Where are we in the?
It's after
timeline, oh.
And it's too far after. It's even though the actors have only aged like 7 years or something, it's almost 20, I think, in Downton Abbey time.
Takes place in 1956.
Yeah, it's all tour groups going through the house. And the other thing I like about it is that at the end of the trailer, where normally a movie would list all the stars of the movie, it lists the character names. It's like, oh, all your favorites.
The Duchess of Bedford.
Chives the butler. Penny the upstairs maid. Gregory the randy gay valet, you know.
Who watches these upstairs downstairs TV shows now? I mean, I can't imagine that it is the coveted demographic of 18 to 35 year old income earners.
It's true, there's plenty of old PBSers, but I don't know, like all the 28 year old young moms and cool girls are knitting now. So
yeah, I guess that's right.
Maybe they're all watching Cozy Mysteries too.
It could be.
They're all listening to true crime podcasts.
Could be that people are, you know, they go to work all day in sweatpants and they come home and they're like, I just want to watch somebody in a starched collar.
This is what I'm missing. Speaking of daily routines, you know, we're speaking to a future audience of, you know, who knows, maybe they're filter feeders or
right.
Maybe they just eat a giant tortoise once a year.
They could be living under a blacked out sky where there is no differentiation between night and day.
But schedule is important. And, you know, whoever you are, I know you metabolize nutrients
right.
in some way.
Must.
Now, that's something we have in common. John and I also
metabolize nutrients.
We
like
do.
You. We reach out to you in a spirit of fellowship.
I mostly eat gems.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What
live on a diet of rubies and emeralds.
John is a silicon-based life form. What do you eat? I'm sure all your podcasts are just you talking at length about your mealtime regimen.
But yeah.
do you sit down to three meals a day?
No, I do not generally eat a breakfast.
I don't
either. Or breakfast. This morning you came into the house just as I was making a weird bowl of
Dalbat
or something. Dalbat and some other curry on top of a bed of rice. But that was like leftover food. I looked in the refrigerator. I was like, I better eat that before it goes bad.
So do you often have an early lunch?
No, I do not.
Leftover takeout?
I do not eat breakfast and I often don't eat lunch. I routinely find that it's 5 o'clock at night before I think about food. And then at five, when I do think about food, I'm like, oh, whoa, I need to eat.
Do you feel hungry or do you just realize it's a thing people do?
I think I start to feel hungry. I start to feel that kind of peckishness where my first thought is, well, I'll just go to a Wendy's and get a chicken sandwich. And then my second thought is don't go to Wendy's and get a chicken sandwich. That's not good for you. You're not living your best life. You should be.
Now these two thoughts are in conflict.
Well, they are, right? Because I want to be someone who goes and gets out the mix master and makes a beet and kale shake. But I end up at Wendy's and I get a chicken sandwich. They have great chicken sandwiches at Wendy's.
You're not, I don't see you ever making a beet and kale shake.
Not willingly. But then my problem is then I eat a really big meal at 9:30 p.m.
Okay, I'm writing this down. So there's some kind of first meal at 5 p.m.
Yeah.
And then there's some kind of a supper, a big dinner at 9:30.
A big dinner at 9:30, which is the wrong time to eat a big dinner, I think.
Well, I mean, by skipping breakfast and lunch, you've really embraced the hot dietary fad right now of intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
The idea that it's better for your body to go long stretches with no food during the day.
It's just an instinct, or I mean, that's just my nature. I don't, when I wake up, I'm not hungry.
I don't wake up hungry either. Who are these people?
I don't know.
Who are these British people eating their lamb chops and kippers and tomato?
I feel like you have to do a different kind of labor than we do, but I don't really.
Do you think that's right? If we had worked physically with our bodies late into the evening?
When my mom talks about how they ate in Ohio when they were, you know, like farmers who didn't have mechanical tools, she said they ate their biggest meal at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's typical, I think, in agrarian societies and even in America to this day, rural families, if they can. But of course, any place with a workplace or a school schedule, that just doesn't work anymore.
Right. But then, you know, they had a little, you know, supper at the end of the day, or I guess they called lunch, supper, and dinner.
I think it's the other way around. They called lunch, dinner. That's right. How my grandparents were. And then dinner was supper. My Southern grandparents always had dinner and supper.
But you know, I used to, before I had these abominable podcasts I had to do every morning, I used to stay up until 4 o'clock in the morning all the time. So having a big meal at 10 o'clock at night it wasn't outrageous. I was
that's
still
the middle
up,
of your day.
Yeah, still up for 6 hours.
Would you keep eating?
Would you
eat a hilarious big sandwich with
a big Dagwood.
Crazy layers at my, 3 a.m.?
My weakness is the bowl of ice cream immediately before bed. You know,
just like all doctors recommend.
I get
four
to
out of five doctors.
It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. Ah, I just need a little something. And what I should have is a slice of cheese. But what I do is have 1,500 calories of vanilla ice cream.
It's really the worst food for it because you eat what seems like a normal volume of food. But of course, if you eat, you know, a bowl of soup-sized thing of ice cream, it's 7,000 calories.
Right, pure fat and sugar. Right.
Right. My own personal Calvary every day is that I love breakfast food, or breakfast, as we say in our time.
Right.
I love breakfast food. I love green eggs and ham. Sam, I am.
You like them at dinner.
Yeah, but I'm not hungry at any time when anyone wants to serve them to me.
Do you like sweet foods?
I do. I really do have a sweet tooth. I feel like I need to earn my little treats.
But is it a pancake-based sweet tooth? Do you like syrup and
yeah, I mean, I love bread? Any kind of, I mean, I love pretty much all breakfast. Name a breakfast food.
French toast.
Love it.
Hash browns.
Love it.
Joe's special.
Yes, two, please. What is Joe's special?
Joe's special is spinach,
hamburger, eggs, and I think like Parmesan like, cheese all mixed together in a scramble.
It seems like something only one restaurant has.
Oh, and onions too. Well, it's somewhere there's some titular Joe that was like, here's what I want. Onions, spinach, eggs.
I'm Joe and I'm special.
And they made it. And then the guy sitting next to him at the bar was like, I'll have that. And pretty soon it was just like an Arnold Palmer.
I love every story like that, where like just one guy, you know, one guy named Caesar is like, I'll put Parmesan cheese and croutons on my romaine lettuce.
Yeah.
And then the world is forever
changed.
And
one herring.
That's what everybody wants, a little anchovy.
What about a breakfast burrito?
Yeah.
Huevos, like, rancheros.
I like the egg-based. I like all the breakfast meats. Bacon more than sausage, but I like them all. And I love the idea that you could just have a big stacks of different kinds of bread that you can pour butter and sticky sweet things on. I mean, what a gift.
What about a bowl of rice with half of a scoop of dalbat and half of a scoop of chicken tikka masala on it for breakfast?
It's true that my idea of breakfast is extremely American. Like, I feel like there's really no... I like going to France and just having some juice and a pastry. That's nice. And I love that you can get mushrooms with your bread, with your breakfast in the UK. But,
Yeah. You
know, growing up in blood Korea, sausage. Everyone would just eat. Yeah, got to have some
blood sausage and tomato. Those are great breakfast foods.
Like growing up in Korea, you'd ride the bus in the morning and everyone would smell like kimchi because they just got up and had rice and kimchi. And it's not a specialized breakfast food there, but it's a very common.
It's what you have.
Breakfast. It's not unusual at all. There's other kinds of porridgey things you could have, but... But rice and kimchi is pretty normal. And to me, it's not just eating in the morning. Like, I just like to have heavy comfort food, and I'm not hungry for it at 9 a.m. So when am I going to eat it?
Right.
I'm never happy.
When I go to a restaurant that serves breakfast but isn't a breakfast restaurant, I look at the clock and ask myself, are we past the French dip line?
What time is the French dip line?
Well, it changes depending on where you are and what the situation is. But I think everyone agrees that at 10 o'clock in the morning, you can't order a French dip unless you're going to break the surly bonds.
You're a serial killer.
Yeah, it's just like, what? But at 11:30, you certainly can order a French dip. So can you order a French dip at 11?
It's around 11. That's the real gray area, right?
So this is the thing. I'm often in a breakfast situation at 10:45. And I go, I can't order a French dip, but I don't want a stack of pancakes. And so I settle on a huevos rancheros because I don't want sweet. I want savory. But it's too early to get a hamburger.
Do you feel like you can't order just a omelet or a Benedict or something? Is it too late for that?
No. I mean, omelet. Because
I'll eat that at any time.
Snooze. Oh, it just feels like a snooze. You know, I don't know if you're aware, but I make egg in a cup, scrambled egg in a coffee mug.
I'm not aware.
It's a wonderful dish that takes 1 minute to cook.
Microwave?
You crack an egg in a mug.
First, take an egg in a mug.
You throw some salt and pepper in on it. You put it in the microwave for 30 seconds. It'll come out. It's already like cooking. Stick a fork in there. Throw some cheese in there. Maybe a little diced up ham. Hit it with the fork. Just sort of half scramble it. Back in the microwave for 30 seconds. You got a mug of delicious scrambled eggs that you are indistinguishable from what you would get in a restaurant for $50 or $100.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Think of all the money you saved.
Yeah.
Like, I can't afford not to be eating these.
That's right. Maybe if you want to use two eggs, you're going to need one of those big mugs. Because the eggs do expand.
I'm not a scrambles versus omelets snob. Like, no. To me, it's all the same. I don't care if it's a beautiful, fancily turned omelet or if it's just all scrambled around in a pan.
A great omelet is a thing of beauty. A poor omelet is a thing of unbeauty.
I think...
It's a thing of duty. D-O-O-T-Y.
Woo! This idea that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, it's presented as a medical fact.
Right.
In fact, it's an advertising slogan.
Quoi?
I think it comes from the early 20th century, and I almost think it's Grape Nuts or Post or whoever makes Grape Nuts. Like, they just said breakfast is the most important meal of the day, and it's the equivalent of McDonald's makes you happy, or
right.
have you driven a Coke lately, or
don't stick anything in your ear bigger than your elbow, which was a advertising slogan for elbow pads.
But now we take it like, vaccinate your kids, like as if it's, right. you know, well, as we all know, breakfast is the most, no, they were just trying to sell you grape nuts, you idiot.
Right.
And nobody would eat something that with the composition of gravel, although I love grape nuts, honestly.
I still don't understand why it sells with that name. Grape nuts.
No grape, no nuts. Originally, I think the sugar was maltose, which was a grape sugar. It's derived from grapes.
Oh, I see.
So it's like some kind of raisin syrup was the sweetener.
I see.
And it's crunchy like a grape.
Seems like nuts.
They've used like modern technology. Grape. And you know, cereal was one of these things where it was like, we've done it. Science has improved meals.
Right.
Because we have done these new things to grains that you could never do before.
Yeah. Marky Post gave us all enemas.
when Marky Post invented cereals, it was a huge, huge day. Did she do it between episodes of Night Court?
She did.
and so grape nuts were one of these things where it's like, look, we've made like a new, it's like a nut, but it right. didn't come off a tree.
It's like space food.
It came from science. Yeah. It's like, yeah. Today it's like buying freeze-dried ice cream and being like, I'm an astronaut. Wee. That's how cereal is born, with the weird sex stuff, which we should probably do
at some point. Cereal sex stuff, for sure.
Yeah, we haven't done any of that.
Well, that's why I said Marky Post.
It's giving me a Marky Post. But the idea that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, or that all these meals are divinely ordained constants in society.
Right. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Not true at all.
Lunch is at noon. Dinner's at 5.
And we organize the workday around them. You know, you take lunch just because it's assumed. Well, of course, I am going to eat a smaller version of dinner at 12:30.
My daughter thinks about lunch so much. And then when she gets out of school, she starts thinking about a snack. If she gets a snack, she starts thinking about dinner.
My theory is this is something we've done by giving people a break associated with food.
Right.
I mean, we didn't mean to just make them associate food as a thing you do not to have to work. You know, we didn't make them think of food as a reward, but that was the effect.
Really is. I think about that. I think about that quite a bit, right?
I work from home, and it's so hard just to not stop in the middle of a sentence that's not going well and just walk to the fridge and kind of gaze over my domain for 45 mm-hmm. seconds
mm-hmm.
because it's easier than working.
I used to work in a bank, and at noon, I would go into the employee lounge.
You'd go into the vault and read Charles Dickens, and then the bombs fell.
I would go in and sleep for an hour.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I didn't want lunch. What I wanted was a nap.
That's your reward.
Yeah.
So like breakfast, for example, in medieval Europe, it was very unfashionable to eat breakfast. I'm not going to say that the Greeks or Romans or Egyptians never eat breakfast.
Really? Unfashionable, you say?
Not even unfashionable, but like sinful. The idea that you would wake up and eat before even going to mass.
Oh.
Right, because there's a religious component to your morning. In the Middle Ages.
Right.
Thomas Aquinas specifically warned against many kinds of gluttony, and one of them was prepropery.
Prepropery.
Which is just liking breakfast. It's the sin of eating too early.
Prepropery, the sin of liking breakfast.
Basically.
Wow.
Because there were other kinds of gluttony for eating too ardently, you know, enjoying your food too much, eating quantities that are too large. But this is specifically getting up and just wanting to eat food. So it's the opposite of the grape nuts philosophy, would be the Thomistic, or as I say, Aquinasian take on breakfast. And there was also an assumption that came with this that it was something low class people did, not just low morals, but low class.
Uh-huh.
A working man, of course, would have to get up and bolt down some porridge before he got to the fields.
Bleh.
But people of quality would never do that.
Right. People of quality, which we talk about all the time. Our future, like skateboarding wombats, are like people of quality. What are you talking about? But it's an obsession in our time,
right?
I think we're leveling now. But
yeah, you and I are convinced that we would have been in any time. We would have been the right sort of people.
Sure, pharaohs, American pharaohs.
So if you don't eat breakfast, what do you eat? Just basically two meals, like, and it was. In an agrarian society, it was like your mom's rural upbringing. That has not changed in 1,000 years. There'd be a big meal.
Pork chops at one in the afternoon.
Middle of the day. Yeah. And then when everybody came in, there'd be a smaller, probably cold meal at night, maybe, you know, leftover whatever from the
doll butt.
And I feel like as recently as like me being a kid visiting my grandparents in the country, that's what it would be, a big Sunday dinner. And then cold cuts from that for, you know, everybody kind of had their own cold supper.
Sure. You go in and take a little bit of turkey off the bottom and make a little plate for yourself. Huh?
It's become, now that I said Sunday, I realize it's kind of become in our time, it's not unusual for Sunday to have the middle of the day be the big meal.
Right. Christmas and Easter. I mean, those are Thanksgiving. Those are days where we have dinner at 3.
We kind of split the difference on Thanksgiving. I feel like we eat around 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Too late for lunch, too early for dinner.
Well, look, my family has never eaten a lunch in their lives.
Why? And why is that? Because they're people of quality?
Well, we just cannot get organized around noon.
A holiday lunch. Exactly.
Or any kind of lunch. I mean, we either have brunch, which is a breakfast lunch.
It's a new invention, as we will see.
Or we have, you know, 2 o'clock lunch, just because I don't know. You try and wrangle cats. That's like getting my people to get in a car at the same time.
I try to wrangle cats all the time. The Industrial Revolution changed the two meal day. The problem is that now people are no longer able to just kind of wander in from the fields during the hottest part of the day and have a refreshing
ham,
ladle of water and a slice of ham. Uh-huh. They're in a factory all day. And so dinner gets pushed later to the end of the workday. And that's kind of what makes the evening meal the big meal. That's the Industrial Revolution gives us that. The dinner gets pushed so later that basically supper has now died. Supper is now pushed out of the meal ecosystem.
Because leaving the factory and walking all the way home, it uses up all the time. So you take a lunch pail to work.
Yeah, what happened is outside, nobody had ever thought of this, that you could set up luncheries where people work. But very quickly after the big factories and plants appeared in the major European and then American cities, little canteens started to appear nearby because they knew people, given time, would duck out for a bite to eat a hot meal, because otherwise they're just bringing whatever cold foods are in their little pail. And supper goes away with two exceptions. You might want a small snack before bed. Or if you're wealthy, it could be, or you know, young and have fun. I'm not young and fun, but if you were, it could be just a late party. So supper became something that the cool, smart, cosmopolitan set did at night. Or just, you know, working class people, so tired after work, they grab a quick snack and hit the hay. So supper kind of, the idea of a late meal kind of dies. And to this day, I don't know, there's not a lot of late. In your rock and roll lifestyle, there are definitely people in diners at 1 a.m.
Right.
But for most Americans over 30... Most people in the West over 30, that's just not a thing.
Well, that bums me out.
Do you wish? Do you think there should be more night eating?
I do. You know, Seattle is terrible.
Seattle shuts down at 9 p.m.
It's so awful. And, you know, when you're in New York, San Francisco's not that great either, but in Los Angeles, if you're hungry, you can go to a restaurant. And in Los Angeles, you're almost certainly going to see Andy Dick there. But in New York, you can get a full, you know, whatever you want, a full complete, you get, you know, Russian pierogies at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And the place might be full.
And full of people. Yeah. And there's a reason. And it's because not all of us get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and exercise for an hour before going to work.
And in New York, a lot of the people that do have those high-powered morning jobs are doing an incredible amount of cocaine or amphetamine.
Yes.
So they're okay.
They don't need food.
They can have a porterhouse steak at
3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Sure.
That's like their time.
But in Seattle, you can count on one hand the number of places you can get any kind of food.
It's not that we're particularly sleepy, although maybe for many years we were kind of Scandinavian and that was not our ethos. But yeah, it's just that most American cities are not big enough. Like most American cities roll up the sidewalks pretty early.
Yeah.
There's like 5 places.
I feel like there should be an entire separate culture that where things do not open until noon and they are open until 8 p.m.
Do you mean when zoos have a nocturnal house? And yeah, like there's a little part of the zoo that observes this totally other world where day is night and night is day. They turn off the, turn on the lights at night and let the armadillos sleep and the lemurs and the whatever.
That should be, we should have that in the industrialized world today.
Because you're a porcupine. You want to wander the streets at night.
I want to wake up when I wake up, and then I still have to go to the DMV sometimes. And I still have to, you know, there's a store over here that closes at 3 p.m. And I'm like, who comes to your store? Or, oh, this is another thing. Any museum that might conceivably attract old men, like car museums and airplane museums, they close at 5 p.m.
All museums close at 5. Their margins must be so thin.
Like, what are you talking about? Like, no, who goes to the museum at 8 in the morning? Nobody. Open the museum at 3 p.m. and stay open till 11.
Some museums do have one night a week where they're open late.
One
and
it's night for a week.
That's right.
Yeah.
Society has thrown you a bone.
Erp.
Like, you're not going to be happy unless you have full and equal rights.
That's exactly right. Thank you. I just want to know who goes to a car museum at 8 in the morning. A significant enough number of people that those are the hours they choose? Or is it just that they're stuck in an old world thinking? They're stuck in some old universe.
Well, here's the thing about olds is they are up and mall walking at 8 a.m.
Yeah, I know.
And if some of them volunteer at the cool car museum, that's the thing that gets them out of bed. They're raring to go stand behind a thing at an empty museum.
In an empty museum.
It's an empty museum.
Docents. That's the problem with the world. Docents.
If we weren't always catering to these docents, the dawn of electric lighting, of course, is what lets dinner be pushed back. You know, right. You can. It's not a problem to cook and sit or to cook a big meal, an elaborate meal, and sit around a family table
at 7 p.m.
Yeah, which where it would have been for most of history.
You don't have to burn 50 candles.
Lunch for working men is a quick, you know, it's a quick, the whistle blows and you can eat out of your little pail, or you can run to the canteens and cafeterias that have appeared near your factory. For middle to upper class people, it's the province of women. You know, the idea that lunch is an elaborate meal, it becomes kind of an effeminate idea.
I see. Sure. A tea.
Right. Tea doesn't exist yet.
Oh.
How many minutes are we in? I just realized we haven't even mentioned the Duchess of Bedford.
26 minutes.
This is good. We should mention the Duchess of Bedford, okay. Right?
Sure.
I mean, so a couple meals have been invented since the Industrial Revolution. You mentioned brunch.
Yep.
The purpose of brunch, then as now, was for drunk people who have had too much to drink.
Thank God. Thank God for us.
A British writer named Guy Berenger in Hunter's Weekly is an anti-docent John Roderick type who's been out late, and he's you no longer are wake up hungover because you've turned over a new leaf,
right? But, or I'm perpetually hungover, depending on how you want to look at it.
Did you just get your 10-year hangover chip?
I used to enjoy being hungover, but I was one of those people.
What is enjoyable about being hungover?
I mean, it just intensifies.
I don't want to know what it intensifies.
It slows you down. You've kind of got a little bit of a fog on everything, but it's a sort of jovial fog. This was true for me. I think a lot of people have terrible headaches and they feel awful, but I was just like a little drunk still. I was a happy drunk.
It's your weed. You need to have it wake up and have a relaxing, foggy morning.
Just kind of roll in, get a cup of coffee, have a little bit of a cookie or something. Everything just seems kind of funny.
So Guy Berenger, knowing that he and his smart set of friends are not going to be up for breakfast, thinks you should be able to have a breakfast-like food, maybe with a little hair of the dog, in the late morning.
Sure.
The name is not centralized for apparently for many years, Punch magazine calls it Blunch.
Yeah, sure. Blunch.
Blunch.
That would be your natural go-to.
It would not be. Here's the problem. Blunch is 1/6 breakfast.
Right. It's
and
lunch.
5/6 lunch. You've given the store away to lunch.
Right. It should be at least brunch or it could even be brunch.
It should be brunch.
Brunch.
If we want to give equal time, it would be brunch.
Yeah, but brunch doesn't sound like breakfast or lunch. It just sounds like. Why not just call it branch?
Brunch seems like it's a violent verb.
Branch.
Like you might get in a wrestling match and your opponent might brunch you.
Yeah, no, I don't want to get brunched. But I would get brunched. I'd definitely get blunched.
So brunch has existed since the 1890s. And as long as young people are doing terrible things to their bodies at night and then not getting up at the time God and Aquinas intended on Saturday morning, there will always be brunch.
Well,
you're very sleepy right now.
I need a brunch. I always associated when I became aware of the concept of brunch, which wasn't always in my life. I believe I, in the 1980s, was introduced to the idea of brunch. It felt like an effeminate meal, a Sunday brunch you would have.
But that's ladies with mimosas only?
But it was ladies. It wasn't a thing that, you know, it didn't seem like a hard-bitten Bukowski meal.
No.
Brunch.
Bukowski has breakfast and he has lunch.
He has blunch, if anything, or branch. Brunch.
Blunch sounds like a Popeye brunch. Villain. The other meal that has been invented within human memory, I mean, not within living memory, but like surprising, you know, almost as close to it as brunch, is something we owe to the Duchess of Bedford.
Who?
She was born Anna Maria Stanhope in 1808 to a good family, I think a family of royal courtiers. And things got even better for her when she married Francis Russell, the Duke of Bedford, which made her the Duchess of Bedford. And I believe the Marchioness of Tavistock, but I don't understand. That seems like I'm just making stuff up. So let's leave it aside.
The thing is, if you marry a duke, you just jumped way up the ladder.
And he's a good duke. Like, I assume some of these dukes are just kind of hereditary losers.
Yeah, they're lesser dukes.
Out in the, you know, some awful part of the Northeast.
But this is a big duke.
The duke, this is a very good one. His brother, in fact, John Russell, later becomes prime minister. So she's politically connected. She's got these royal connections. And as a result, she becomes one of Queen Victoria's ladies in waiting. In fact, she's one of the ladies of her bedchamber at the beginning of Queen Victoria's reign. She spends 5 years as one of the ladies of the bedchamber, which is not as sexy as it sounds.
Ladies of the bedchamber. Sounds pretty sexy.
You wish you had a duchess in a big hat to be your lady of the bedchamber. But in this case, I think it's much more just your proximity to the queen is where all the power is. It's, right. You know, you're the one that gets called for a drink of water or to help her lace up her corset.
Oh, so it is a job. It's not just that you sit near her bedchamber also ringing a little bell to get cakes brought to you.
I guess I shouldn't say lacing up the corset, because you're right. There is a servant class for that.
Of course.
But no, it is for like companionate things and the kind of things that, you know, today you're not going to meet royalty, but you might run across wealthy or famous people with assistants.
Yes.
Who are supposed to run and get your stationery or see if anyone's in the lounge. And that's
right.
That would be the Duchess of Bedford's job.
The assistant I always want is someone who leans over and whispers the name of the person who's walking up right now. When I ran for city council, I had someone who followed me everywhere. And when I would enter a room, they would be right over my shoulder. And somebody would be like, "Hey, John Roderick." And the little voice would say, he's the guy that runs the, you know, the county department of corrections.
And this is not schizophrenia. You had a guy for that.
I had a person, a female person. And it gave me superpowers. Because then I'd be like, "Bill, how are you? Great. How's it going over there at the county?" And it was because I could take it from there, right? As soon as I knew who it was. But it made me just seem like a genius.
I don't even need that in a campaign. I need that in regular life.
That's what I'm saying. If I just had somebody that was like,
I just need somebody to say, "Ken, that's Ben Gibbard. You've met him six times. He's he's the front man of Death Cab for Cutie."
Well, I mean, and I would like somebody that was like, "Your PIN number is 57441.
I mean, I have my notes app and my Gmail where I'm always sending future Ken things I don't want him to forget. But but you don't have it in social scenarios.
No, it's terrible. You can't. Well, I do it all the time. Look at my phone and go like, "Who is that? What's the name?" And I forget that I haven't put in all the metadata I need to. So I'm like, "Who was the guy that used to work at, you know, at Cellophane Square?" And I put Cellophane Square in. No, it's not it. 90s friends. No, I like, and so I don't have the metadata that would call him up. I know his name is in my phone and I'm doing but this who? As he's walking across the room. I can see him and he's like, "John." And I'm like,
this is a good video game idea. People come at you at a party and it's not first person shooter. It's first person. Like,
yeah. Who is
contact
this?
App user. We were at, Mindy and I were at a movie this weekend and some guy in the lobby sees me and is like, "Hey, Ken." And I do like, "Hey
there,
how's it going,
feller?"
Hopefully the asymmetry of the no name is not the first thing he notices. And he's like, is Mindy here? And I was like, yeah, she went in ahead of me. I was parking the car. Are you, I assume we'll see you in there. And he's like, no, it's sold out. I'm kind of standing by. And I was like, okay, well, good luck. I hope you get in. And I go into Mindy and I was like, did you see the guy in the lobby? Who is that? He asked about you. She was like, what? No, who is it? And I was like, I don't know. He's like a friendly Asian guy. And she was like, oh, I think that's a guy we always see who always says hi and asks about me by name because he's read your Wikipedia entry.
Oh, so not a friend, just a stranger.
Well, a stranger is just a friend you haven't met yet.
That's true.
But I'm sure this guy has probably introduced himself to me multiple times and been like, how are Mindy and the kids?
Right.
And
you're like, hey.
So in that case, maybe it's good to not be too chummy. I don't know.
Not very long ago, I was at some event and I walked up to, or somebody came over to me and I was like, hey, you know, I knew the person and I was like, how's it going? He said, great. You know, just working as a publicist at this event. And I was like, how long have you been doing that? Working in publicist at this event. And he was like, the entire time I've known you, 12 years. I'm the official publicist of this event. And I was like, of course, I knew that.
The thing about heads-up displays is like when we have a little chip in front of our retina or whatever, the person will appear and it will not only say his name, it'll be like, you've already asked him where he works. Right. You know, you've met his kids once.
Right. Here's what he does. Let me replay for you the scene just briefly, the last time you saw one another so you can recall it.
And we'll all become hyper aware of this little eye fleck that people do when they meet you.
Yeah.
When he's like, he didn't know. He's remembering right
you're
now.
You're reading my Wikipedia page.
So while she's in service to Queen Victoria doing these kind of assistant tasks.
The Duchess of Bedford...
Does two newsworthy things. Otherwise, she's a total footnote in history. Basically, you know, one of Queen Victoria's many courtier ladies-in-waiting and a sister-in-law to a prime minister. That's not enough to get you into the history books. But she does do two kind of interesting things. The first one, which is a bit of an aside, but I don't want to skip it because it's a little bit juicy, is because she is near the center of the Flora Hastings affair. Mm-hmm. Do you like royal intrigues?
Mm-hmm.
But you don't watch Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
Flora, so early in Queen Victoria's, and even before, Flora Hastings was a lady-in-waiting to the Duchess of Kent, Queen Victoria's mother, the equivalent of the Queen Mum
mm-hmm.
at the time. And this was a time when the Duchess of Kent, Queen Victoria's mother, and her Hanoverian uncles, mm-hmm. the strict Germans that are always around the palace, they're indulging in something called...
Whist.
In addition to whist... the Kensington system, which is what they called their genius idea, whereby they would keep Queen Victoria from knowing the future Queen Victoria, and then in her early years Queen Victoria, from knowing anything that was going on, so they could pretty much run Britain as de facto regents on her behalf.
This was the Kensington system.
Yeah, they had a name for their kind of semi-legal. Maybe there's a name for today, the thing that keeps the wrong paper off Trump's desk or whatever, you know.
Wow.
The Mattis system or whatever.
This was going to backfire on them when she became the longest reigning queen in history. Well, and
what you have to remember is they didn't know that.
Right.
Nobody was like, why are you doing that to Queen Victoria? And they're like, oh, she's not Queen Victoria yet. But it's basically a huge conspiracy. Don't let her know anything that's going on. And Victoria knows, and she's pissed. And she knows that her own mom is in on it because, you know, the Queen Mum has nothing to do. She's out the door once the heir takes to the throne.
Right. So why not?
So it's in the mom's interest to keep the uncles holding the reins because, you know, then she's got some hold on power. So there's a courtier named John Conroy that Victoria hates because he was complicit with her mother and uncles in the Kensington system. And later on in 1839, when Victoria is queen, Lady Flora Hastings, so at this point, Queen Victoria has kept her mom and the whole former Kensington apparatus as far away from London as possible. They've basically been exiled to far corners of the realm where they can have little influence on palace affairs. But one of the Duchess of Kent, the Queen Mother's ladies-in-waiting, is a woman named Flora Hastings, who begins to experience abdominal pain and swelling in 1839.
Boy, I know what this means in 1839.
If you've ever seen a woman clutch her stomach, a woman in a movie who coughs is going to die.
Okay.
A woman in a movie who looks a little queasy is going to have a baby.
Oh, I see.
And that's what was going on then. She visited, when Flora Hastings visited the royal physician, he was like, well, I can give you an examination. And she was like, nope. And so everybody in the palace starts saying, Lady Flora is not married and Lady Flora is pregnant. And she still has enemies left over from this, from the Kensington system. And one of them is the Duchess of Bedford, not the main one, but the Baroness Lezen, which kind of seems like a fake lady in waiting from some kind of Victorian erotica.
Right. Baroness Lezen swanned into the room.
Baroness Lezen wearing only, we'll leave it there.
Only 14 petticoats attracted the eye of every suitor.
And our character, the Duchess of Bedford, begin to circulate rumors to the effect that Flora Hastings is pregnant with John Conroy's baby.
And is the Duchess of Bedford working on behalf of Victoria to discredit John Conroy by making him the what would you call it? The seducer?
The father. It certainly flatters the queen and reinforces her prejudices and interests if the father is John Conroy.
Right.
So, of course, that's the kind of thing you tell the queen everyone's whispering about, because you know if the queen hears it from, hears the palace gossip from you, that's a point in your favor.
Right.
And unfortunately, in this case, this has a unhappy ending. The queen is writing in her journal that her enemies, Conroy and Flora Hastings, are having a baby, and how can she use this? And Lady Flora even has to write an open letter to the examiner saying, I have heard the scandalous rumors about me, and a certain foreign lady has been speaking. The Baroness Lezen was, Russian descent, maybe?
Of course.
Anyway, Lady Flora, months later, the symptoms are not getting better. She does consent to an examination, and it turns out she has advanced cancer of the liver.
Oh, no.
It's a huge tumor.
Ow.
And
this became less funny all of a sudden.
Yeah, and Queen Victoria realizes it's become less funny, and Queen Victoria feels awful and goes to visit Lady Flora, but it's June. She's on her deathbed, clearly emaciated, and Victoria tries to make amends, but Flora Hastings dies. And I think Victoria is haunted by it for the rest of her life, that she spoke ill of the dying gleefully. So that's one of the things the Duchess of Bedford gave to Britain was
guilty conscience to Queen Victoria.
That's right. For decades.
So anyway, that's why she sparked the Boer War.
Yeah, I think you can all trace it back to this moment. But the other thing that she gave was, getting back to mealtime, happened in the 1840s when she was visiting the Duke of Rutland at Belvoir Castle in Leicestershire. Now, tea had been introduced to Europe surprisingly recently, late 17th century.
Is that true?
King Charles II of Portugal married, or no, sorry, King Charles II of England married Catherine of Braganza, a Portuguese queen. And I guess Portugal had the early access to all this African and then New World stuff.
Right.
Because they had all the early navigators and explorers. But it didn't come to England until Charles II married a Portuguese woman who was like, no, I've got to have my hot leaf water. This is what is done by the best people.
Now, this was not connected to any kind of coffee boycott or coffee scandal?
The tea predates the coffee in Europe, right? The coffee would have had to come from Brazil. Coffee's a New World plant. The tea came from India, and I'm sure had always been known, you know, Constantinople into Rome. But the trade of it depended on these new Portuguese trade routes of the 16th and 17th centuries. So, you know, tea became just from this unknown thing that you would put leaves in hot water and get a little pick-me-up, became very quickly went from just a totally exotic, weird thing to a novelty, to a fad, to basically today what it is, the basis of British culture, such right. as it is.
Tea.
You must have your...
It started the revolution. The Minutemen were ready on the move.
They needed their tea just as much. They were British subjects at the time.
Right.
You know, like anything that messed with tea was a big deal. And I don't think it's an accident that that was the particular bit of foreign policy and taxation policy that really stuck in the colonist craw. Because in just 100 years, it went from the hot new thing at court that Catherine of Braganza had brought from Portugal to just a staple of British life and sociality. And of course, in Victoria's era, when it's a symbol of her empire, you know, the...
Right, the universality of it.
From East meets West. Yes, and from our tea, you know, from our bustling and affluent tea plantations in India and all these other benighted parts of the world that we've brought God and Queen and country to, it's a symbol of British dominion over Asia and over the seas.
Right.
So for the last, you know, century, 150 years, you know, tea has slowly been catching on. But that's tea, the beverage. Tea was not really spoken of much as a meal. I mean,
oh, I see. Having tea, yes. Meaning tea and cakes.
If you were having tea, that means, you know, you might be drinking a cup of tea in addition to what you're doing,
but not having a repast in the afternoon. Yes,
it's not part of the day. You know, there's not a tea time even.
Right.
Even though tea is being drunk, but in the 1840s, while visiting Leicestershire, it appears that Anna Maria Stanhope, the Duchess of Bedford, is going through a hard time. Maybe she still feels some guilt over her treatment of Lady Flora Hastings. I don't know.
Yes.
But her descriptions of the visit make it seem like it's about as dreary as the Downton Abbey trailer.
She's languishing.
She describes a sinking feeling that comes over her every afternoon, which, you know, in our modern language, you might recognize as possibly something that she should talk to a therapist about.
Right.
Like, is she depressed?
Although in our modern language, you are completely forbidden from having sympathy for rich people. So.
Oh, you have a sinking feeling. Maybe you should just go ride your polo ponies and count your jewels and your tiaras.
So she's sitting up having ennui, rich people ennui.
She has rich people ennui.
Yeah.
RPE. She's got a bad case of RPE. And as a result, she needs something to break up these long, lonely afternoons. I guess they eat supper there late.
Right. She should try eating gems like I do. They fill you with...
But then she wouldn't have her gems anymore.
Oh, yeah, well.
I don't know. Can you always just keep eating and excreting gems?
Yeah. As far as I mean, every time I eat a gem, a little 100 appears over my head.
Bling. Da-ding, da-ding. So she starts inviting some of the ladies up to her chambers where they have Darjeeling tea.
Nice.
The drink that's universally accepted as what rich ladies drink.
Right.
But she's also a little peckish because supper is served much later than her custom at the Duke's castle. And so she also serves some little cakes, some little sandwiches to a small circle of friends.
With the crust cut off.
Right.
Little petty fours.
Right. And of course, this is no surprise to any of us who know the custom of English afternoon tea. That's exactly what you eat. Bread and butter, little sandwiches, little pastries, and a pot of tea. But this didn't exist at the time.
This was a revolution.
Right. She's just kind of inventing, like, it's like the person we all know who's like, guess what? I have a friend like this. We're going to cook food from all the countries of the world in order. This month is Afghanistan month.
Oh, I thought
next month it's at your house and we're having Albanian food. Then it's Algerian food in June.
I imagined it was one event, all the countries in order. And I was like, how do you order the countries by size?
There's 180 tables here. But do you know people like this who always have some idea? It's going to be so fun. We're going to work through every coupon in this book, and we're going to go to every restaurant on Capitol Hill in alphabetical order. Or here's a fun new thing. We're doing a book club, but we're going to read only books that are out of print. Or
I told you
it's
that
exhausting.
When my mom moved to Seattle, she found a phone book, the white pages, ripped the page out that had every church in Seattle. And began at the top and went to a service.
You did just tell me this.
Just made her plan. I'm going to go to a service at every church in Seattle. And she did.
Did she get to the Zoroastrians at the end?
She went all the way. She spent a few hours with every single denomination in town.
She should write a book. Like, because that's the trend in, for a while it was the trend in publishing to do these kind of faddish things, right. You know, like.
I ate a McDonald's hamburger every day
for a year. Yeah. Or. So this is her kind of her fun little novel afternoon thing that the smart people do. And it really catches on. Everyone who's done this is like, yeah, I mean, if you have the choice of not eating little sandwiches and pastries at four or eating little sandwiches and pastries at four, you're totally going to eat it.
Why didn't we do this all the whole time?
Have you ever had the traditional English high tea?
Yeah.
Afternoon tea?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've never done it at Tavern on the Green, but I've consorted with tea in the afternoon people.
When we're I've done it as a tourist. Like I've done it in London because the kids think it's.
Oh.
So if, I mean, it's just a chance. If you're a kid, you know what would be better than weird little sandwiches and then a bunch of like because they serve it on a multi-level tray, yeah. Which is fun.
That's cute.
And you go to any of these nice tea places, and it is 100% tourists now. That's who's eating. That's who wants to have high tea is Americans and Emiratis and Russians in London.
The first time I realized I liked sandwiches, I think, was as a result of a tea.
Wait, what?
As a kid,
didn't eat sandwiches for lunch?
No, I was a picky eater. The only sandwiches I would eat were like plain hamburgers or grilled cheese sandwiches. But I had never had a ham and cheese sandwich or a roast beef and cheese sandwich. And I was at...
Your French dip line is like at 10 years old.
Yeah, I was at some event that was some kind of like party at a women's garden club. And they had those little multi-tier trays with little... sandwiches with the crusts cut off, and I ate one that was, I think, turkey, cheese, lettuce, and mayonnaise, and I thought I had never tasted something so good.
How old were you in the story?
I don't know, 10, probably. And after that, I was like, sandwiches.
I'm going to call it the Roderick. I've invented it.
Get to me a sandwich. And I've loved every kind of sandwich ever since. I can name every sandwich.
I mean, I'm not in love with the idea of afternoon tea. I mean, to me, it seems like a meal where if it didn't exist, you wouldn't invent it. Like, I ate something at, I mean, if you're not on your weird clock, right. I ate something at 1, I'm going to eat something at 6. If I eat high tea, if I eat 3 little sandwiches and 3 little pastries at 4 o'clock.
3 little birds.
I'm not going to want 3 calling birds and 4 French hens. I'm not going to want dinner in 2 hours.
But what if you have lunch at noon and dinner at 7:30?
Yeah, I mean, if you're, I mean, you know, I remember living in Spain and watching people just start going, heading down to the restaurants and the plazas at 10 p.m. at night.
Yeah.
And thinking, this is for me. This is great.
Yeah.
And I guess that's true. If I wasn't, so maybe this is perfect for a non-breakfast person like me. Get up and eat something light and breakfast like around noon. I mean, get up at a normal time, but not eat until noon.
Whatever you call normal, sure. Eat at noon.
Have your high tea, have your clotted cream on scones at 4. And then have dinner late.
Yeah, your breakfast would be...
You're just pushing everything up 4 hours.
Your breakfast is 2 hot dogs.
My breakfast would not be 2 hot dogs, but go on.
And then at tea, you have 2 donuts. And then you take a long nap. And then you wake up at 9. And then at 10 o'clock, you have 4 pounds of lasagna. And then at... 2 in the morning, you have a big bowl of ice cream.
This doesn't seem that healthy.
And then you go dancing.
Like, you should not be eating 2 donuts when you could have a bunch of little cucumber sandwiches.
I guess.
But, I mean...
What if I slice the donuts, put cucumbers in them?
It's a huge difference across the Atlantic is the degree to which tea and breaks for tea and scheduling around tea are just foundational to the British people now. Like, no matter where you work, like... You know, coffee breaks are observed in the U.S., but it's a way of speaking. It's like, you know, what did you do on your coffee break? I went to the restroom. I went to the drugstore.
Right.
You know, I checked my email. Whereas in Britain, there is a tea break, and the tea trolley might come in with things on it. During the World War I, this was kind of, this was actually kind of a government program. This is the age of efficiency, and people were very worried about the munitions industry being affected by the industrial fatigue of people having to make bombs all day. And so a Bristol physiology professor named A.F. Stanley Kent was, unless my notes are wrong, and I just, he's a professor A.F. This guy is erudite A.F. He's dispatched to these factories to see what he can do. And he says, oh, you need to give the workers a tea break. And of course, the factory owners, as you might recall from the Mother Jones entry, said, no, actually, we are not going to do that. We're going to just make them work instead. And he said, no, productivity will go up. And they said, no, we'll be the judge of that. And he said, no, His Majesty's government will be the judge of that.
Kapow.
Yeah, you're getting shut down unless you give tea breaks. Like, you want to lose your military contracts? You need to give tea breaks. And so, you know, under the auspices of this kind of efficiency thinking and the crown, tea breaks became just the de facto standard in British workplaces.
And life. Did productivity improve?
I think it did. You know, I don't have A.F. Stanley Kent's numbers. I'm not prepared AF.
My productivity improves if I have a little tea break.
I think it's really bad for my productivity to have. I do too many. Do you know people who do the small meal thing where they'll just eat like?
Oh, I know.
You need to eat 8 small meals a day. That's what the body wants.
I do it, and then I eat 4,000 calories worth of spaghetti at 11 p.m.
But what if you were speaking to sea creatures who are filtering krill into their baleen constantly?
I mean,
they don't even know what it means to stop eating.
Or maybe an ant colony, you know, develops a singular intelligence and they're like, that's all we do all day is eat, you know, carry tiny bits of sugar back to the queen.
Part of my organism is always eating all the time. And that's true of me. Part of my organism is always eating all the
always
time.
Eating out.
That's why I have the doughy self you see before you.
I mean, part of my organism is always eating its heart out. And that concludes The Duchess of Bedford, entry 383.PR2301, certificate number 48479 in the omnibus. Futurelings, we have no idea how long our civilization will survive.
Dude. You are very sleepy right now. John's not just doing whatever that was, a Dr. John impression. He's also he's too sleepy to enunciate.
In the unlikely event that social media still exists in y'all
play some Zydeco for y'all.
Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, I'll have the Omnibus Project. Our handles were Ken Jennings and John Roderick. Ow.
I guarantee.
I was on Instagram. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Support our Patreon.
Patreon. What if they spell it wrong because they don't put in the letter N?
Patreon. Name's right in it. N is right in it. Patreon.com at Omnibus Project. You can email us. I said that already.
Physical mail.
Mail us stuff at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98166.
98155. Is this part of your character that he...
I don't know.
Increases all numbers by one?
I can't see anymore.
You're a blind blues musician. Yeah. I just got it.
And no. I'm just tired. And you go to Facebook and Reddit.
And so forth.
Y'all. Do it.
Listeners.
Get on it.
From our vantage point here in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization served. I don't even know how long we have until John falls asleep.
That's true.
We hope and pray that this world-ending catastrophe may never come. But if the worst comes soon, if it comes by tea time, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word to you. But if Providence allows, we hope to be returned to you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.